Hey, thanks, John. I don't know why he always gives me the difficult topics to talk about. I'd rather talk about sex than like two, three weeks ago than talk about this. But anyway, here I am again. Just where are the leadership guys? We just should see that John start earning his salary by tackling some of the difficult topics himself from now on. But anyway, okay, so we talk about the theology of ecology, and by the way, there are so many different approaches, that, you know, or angles from which to approach this. And so I sort of wondered, you know, what angle we should really have. But we are primarily busy with a series on Genesis. Okay, so I'm going to use the biblical text rather as a foundation, and then just elaborate on that a little bit. But before we get to that, there's just one little DVD that we're going to look at first. So, who of you watched the movie Earthlings? Can I just okay? One of you. Well, yeah. By the way, if you really want to have a good theology of ecology, talk to Valdo. He's really has captured a lot of good ideas and is actually living the life as well. So, it is. There's one or two scenes. It's about a 5-minute clip, but there are one or two scenes that maybe is a little bit sensitive. So sensitive viewers, just sort of, you know, kijk deze beschrijving en dan zie je het gevaarlijk lijkt me af toe. All right, so here we go.
Since we all inhabit the earth, all of us are considered earthlings. There is no sexism, no racism, or speciesism in the term earthling. It encompasses each and every one of us, warm or cold-blooded, mammal, vertebrae or invertebrae, bird, reptile, amphibian, fish, and human alike. Humans, therefore, being not the only species on the planet, share this world with millions of other living creatures as we all evolve here together. However, it is the human earthling who tends to dominate the earth, oftentimes treating other fellow earthlings and living beings as mere objects. This is what is meant by speciesism. By analogy with racism and sexism, the term speciesism is a prejudice or attitude of bias in favor of the interest of members of one's own species and against those of members of other species. If a being suffers, there can be no moral justification for refusing to take that suffering into consideration. No matter what the nature of the being, the principle of equality requires that one suffering can be counted equally with the like suffering of any other being. Racists violate the principle of equality by giving greater weight to the interests of members of their own race when there's a clash between their interests and the interests of those of another race. Sexists violate the principle of equality by favoring the interests of their own sex. Similarly, speciesists allow the interests of their own species to override the greater interests of members of other species. each case, the pattern is identical. Though among the members of the human family we recognize the moral imperative of respect, every human is a somebody, not a something. Morally disrespectful treatment occurs when those who stand at the power end of a power relationship treat the less powerful as if they were mere objects. The rapist does this to the victim of rape, the child molester to the child molested, the master to the slave. In each and all such cases, humans who have power exploit those who lack it. Might the same be true of how humans treat other animals or other earthlings? Undoubtedly, there are differences, since humans and animals are not the same in all respects. But the question of sameness wears another face. Granted, these animals do not have all the desires we humans have. Granted, they do not comprehend everything we humans comprehend. Nevertheless, we and they do have some of the same desires and do comprehend some of the same things. The desires for food and water, shelter and companionship, freedom of movement and avoidance of pain. These desires are shared by non-human animals and human beings. As for comprehension, like humans, many non-human animals understand the world in which they live and move. Otherwise, they could not survive. So beneath the many differences, there is sameness. Like us, these animals embody the mystery and wonder of consciousness. Like us, they are not only in the world, they are aware of it. Like us, they are the psychological centers of a life that is uniquely their own. In these fundamental respects, humans stand on all fours, so to speak, with hogs and cows.
Regardless of what your opinion is at this moment on the whole ecology thing, and regardless of what you've experienced up until now, where people, according to you, you know, abused the whole topic or cause, or they overstated their points of view or whatever, I just wanted to start from an angle that I think is very biblical, and that's the question, first of all, before we address all these things. And this is the question: what kind of person do you want to become? If your answers would include any of the following: if you want to be loving, caring, respectful, non-discriminate, compassionate, or moral, I think this message or this kind of topic tonight have a challenge, has a challenge for each and every one of us. So let's say for a moment that the collective word for all the above mentioned terms, is compassion. Just for a moment, and we would like to say, or challenge each other to extend our compassion, to widen the borders of our compassion. When we think of being compassionate, we usually think of compassion in relation to other human beings, the less fortunate, the outcast, or whatever. Or we really ever think of coming generations, but only what's going on really in the present. But if we could have the opportunity to be compassionate towards all of creation, would we take it? Would you take it? Would you consider it to be fundamentally important? And I do want to add this sentence as well, especially if you're a Christian. Would you consider that being part of what God intended for us and to be our calling? Now, the very interesting thing, just a few very interesting things, we as Westerners today, now when I talk about we as Westerners, I don't mean that Africa is necessarily included in the Western lifestyle, but most of our white people in South Africa live Western lifestyles. So we as Westerners make out 20% of the, well, more or less 20% of the world's population, but we consume 80% of the world's resources. By that we mean primarily food, and several forms of energy. So as a result, excessive amounts of carbon dioxide are being pumped into the atmosphere. We get a warmer atmosphere. The implication of that is warmer oceans. When we have warmer oceans, we have very intense storms, and we get much more severe droughts. And that changes the climate of our planet, and in the end threatens the life of people on the Earth and of all sorts of life forms on the Earth. Like, for instance, just a very simple example. In the Netherlands, they did research and they came to know that there are migrating birds from the southern parts of Africa that get there each year around about the 25th of April, and their babies hatch around about the 3rd of June every year, alongside a lot of caterpillars that get out of the cocoon so that there could be food for the birds. That was 25 years ago. Now, about 25 years later, the caterpillars hatch 2 weeks before the birds get born, or before the birds hatch, because of the changes in climate. So there are no more food left for the baby birds. That's just one way in which the climate changes has a big influence on nature itself. There are countless of examples. The big question, what causes this? And I know it's not rocket science for many of us, but I think let's start with the beginning. What causes this? And the answer is, plain and simple, human consumption of energy. More than that, excessive consumption of energy. In other words, what I mean by excessive is more than is necessary. We demand comfort as Westerners. So we demand eating meat 3 times a day. Animals are being grown into maturity in cages. Through growth hormones. Some of them never seeing the light of day, by the way. We demand to eat certain fruits and vegetables out of season, so it needs to be taken from some other, sometimes impoverished countries, transported to South Africa, and again, the carbon dioxide is pumped to the atmosphere, the whole thing gets heated up, and so the thing goes on. We demand comfort in terms of things like air conditioning. For instance, we don't realize how much energy some of those things take. And the United States alone uses more energy for air conditioning than the rest of the world combined, but apparently not for long. 12 of the 13 hottest cities in the world are the fastest growing regions of Southeast Asia and will have had a billion new consumers, air conditioning consumers, by 2025. That means that we will have the USA times 4 in 10 years' time in terms of energy. So what's important to understand is we are not living naturally off the land as some of our predecessors did. We are not living off the land, like, for instance, the way we live off interest. If the interest is like 10% and we consume 10%, you can carry on like this indefinitely. All right, it's not rocket science. But if the interest is 10% and you consume 15%, you're eating into your own capital. And within 20 years, you will have nothing left. That is just what is happening with our planet at the moment. We consume far more than the planet can take. And this is not all of the people on the planet. The Westerners, us, we who are sitting here tonight, the 20%, we consume much more than can really be provided by the planet. I don't see if I can slide the opposite. If you look at this, you can see the biocapacity is the capacity of the planet. That's what the planet can take. And like you can see from 1961, the capacity of what the planet can provide decreased as the years went by. The red is our ecological footprint. In other words, it's what we consume at the moment. And this whole pink piece in between, that's actually the ecological footprint. That is the difference, the debt that we are actually owing the planet in terms of resources because we take more than we really should. So how can we really demand this? If we are the 20% that actually demand to take 80% of the world's resources, how How do we do that? It's very easy. We have the power because we have the money. Like, for instance, the Markinor research a few years back, just on the South African situation, posed that 49% of the people in the country are poor, with a household's monthly income less than 2,500 rand a month. 49% of our country earn less than 2,500 rand per month. 4%, only 4% of us earn more than 25,000 rand per month. So if you are in that bracket, or your parents were in those, were in that kind of income bracket, it means that we are the part of the 4% stinking rich people in this country. And as being the richest, we have the most power. And because we have the most power, we pay for what we want. We have the power to do that. And that means that we actually have the power to consume more than the other people. So the West spends more, like for instance, on makeup, ice cream, and pet food in a year than it would cost to give the rest of the population clean water, food, and basic education. So I ask you again, what kind of person do you want to be? And looking at the church, what kind of community do you think the church should be like? So what was God's original intent? How, you know, does he have something to say about this? And of course, he has something to say about this. So what we're going to do, just with this little background, and please, this is new for a lot of us. For some of us, it's really not rocket science. We've been through this. We actually know all of this. So be patient. I really went through hell to sort of distinguish what should I say, what should I leave out, because I'm really trying to shorten up my talks now. So it was a rather big challenge, you know, to decide what to say and what to say and what not to say. So please engage in the Q&A afterwards and take me out if you want. But so let's, with this brief word of background, let's go to some texts in Genesis 1 and 2 and just see what God had in mind and what does he consider to be one of our primal callings. The first one is from Genesis 1, just three very popular verses that we know very well, 26 to 28. God spoke, "Let us make human beings in our image, make them reflecting our nature, so they can be responsible for the fish in the sea." Important in some of the translations, that term, "be responsible," was translated having dominion. Okay, we're going to talk about that just now. So they can be responsible for the fish in the sea, the birds in the air, the cattle, and yes, the earth itself, and every animal that moves on the face of the earth. God created human beings. He created them godlike, reflecting God's nature. He created them male and female. God blessed them. Prosper, reproduce, fill the earth, take charge. These are such good translations. Be responsible for fish in the sea. That word "responsible" again in some of the other translations is have dominion, rule over the fish in the sea, the birds in the air, for every living thing that moves on the face of the earth. Now it's important just to talk about this word dominion for a few moments, because it was in our era, the era that we've been brought up in, it was taken for granted that word dominion, of course, uncritically, simply means that we have the right to rule the animals and the plant world in such a way as actually to exploit them if we would like to do that. God gave us the power to do that. But that's a misunderstanding of actually when this term was introduced. The first one that we know of that introduced this term was Francis Bacon in the 1700s. He was actually the father of modernism to a big extent, who hijacked the Genesis text into meaning total control and imperialist rulership that led to the current exploitation. Now, it's important to understand, and I must confess that I grew up with the idea when I read this text that God meant it as follows. God is at the top. He rules over everything. Just underneath him is me, you know, us, we as the human beings, and just beneath us is, you know, are all the animals and the rest of creation. So we are almost, you know, in a semi-godlike fashion, between God and the animals, having the right to rule over them. And that's why I like the translation of Eugene Peterson, who says, rather taking responsibility. I think that's a much better translation, because if you look at the context of where the verses are, it's being used in the whole idea of looking after the land, tilling the ground, tilling the soil, looking after the animals, naming them, and so forth and so on. It's like a caring dominion. In other words, we should remember that the whole of the biblical text is about the kingdom of God. We all know that. We've spoken of it many, many times. The main message of Jesus was about the kingdom of God. Jesus came to establish God's kingdom. It is that which went wrong years and years ago in Genesis 3. We know everything about those three relationships that went wrong: man and God, man and fellow man, and man and nature. And so the whole idea is, like Jesus said, like Jesus showed us, he is the king of God's kingdom. But what's the way that how does he rule? He does not rule and get to the Pax Romana through the Roman way of empire and through violence. He is the king that rules by giving up power. He is the king that rules by sacrificing himself. It's the same kind of idea. This is before the fall, where God's trying to say to human beings, rule nature the way I would rule them, with caring kind of dominion, tilling the earth and making it productive. In other words, ruling like God means making creation flourish, making it productive, taking the best out of it and putting it back so that it can actually increase in health and goodness and productivity. So the dominion here is not caring, is my caring, not imperialistic. It's caring like God. And by the way, what's interesting is right through the rest of the Old and New Testament, when never again are human beings really put in the direct position, and is the word dominion used in correlation with man's relationship towards nature. Okay, so let's look at a second passage that is much more illuminating even than the first one. That comes from Genesis chapter 2. At the time, God made the earth and the heaven before any grasses or shrubs had sprouted from the ground. God hadn't yet sent the rain on earth, nor was there anyone around who worked the ground. The whole earth was watered by underground springs. God formed man out of the dirt from the ground and blew into his nostrils the breath of life. The man came alive, a living soul. Then God planted a garden in Eden, in the east. He put the man he had just made in it. God made all kinds of trees grow from the ground, trees beautiful to look at and good to eat. The tree of life was in the middle of the garden, also the tree of knowledge of good and evil. A river flows out of Eden to water the garden, and from there divides into four rivers. The first is named the Pishon. It flows through Havilah, where there is gold. The gold of this land is good. Just remember this, by the way. If I don't say anything about it, ask me in the Q&A about this gold thing. The land is also known for a sweet-scented resin and the onyx stone. The second river is named the Gion, Afrikaans Gion. Né? It flows through the land of Cush. The third river is named the Hiddekel, or the Tigris in later years, and flows east of Assyria. And the fourth river is the Euphrates. God took the man and set him down in the Garden of Eden to work the ground and to keep it in order. God commanded man, "You can eat from any tree in the garden except from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Don't eat from it. The moment you eat from that tree, you're dead." God said, "It's not good for man to be alone. I'll make him a helper, a companion." So God formed from the dirt of the ground all the animals of the field and all the birds in the air. He brought them to the man to see what he would name them. Whatever the man called each living creature, that was his name. The man named the cattle, named the birds of the air, named the wild animals, but he didn't find a suitable companion. God put the man to a deep sleep. As he slept, he removed one of his ribs and replaced it with flesh. God then used the rib that he had taken from the man to make woman and presented her to the man. All right. One phrase that's being repeated in this text over and over again is the term from the dirt, from the ground. It's being repeated, I think, four times, and a fifth time when God sent Adam back to actually work the ground. Why is this so important? It's interesting to see that God, just in the previous passage, God formed man out of the dirt. Okay, we all know that, very important. And then God made all the trees to grow from where? From the ground. Then we see he sent the man to go work the ground. Then we see in verse 18 to 20, God formed from the dirt of the ground all the animals of the field and all the birds of the air. He brought them to the man to see what he would name them, and so forth and so on. So what's very important is the common origin of men with the animals and with the plants. God grew the plants from the dirt, from the ground. He grew the animals from the ground. He made man from the ground, and he blew his own breath into man. And most commentaries say that this is an extremely important phrase. It's a poetic repetition of the whole phrase, from the ground, into the ground, from the ground, from the ground, the whole time. Saying what exactly? Saying that human beings have some kind of kinship with the rest of the animal world. We have some kind of kinship. We are, in some sense, family with the rest of creation. We are all creatures. Although God endowed us with special functions, with intelligence, and with something that is God-like, in one sense, we are family with the rest of creation. In the terms of the movie, we're all earthlings. We are all from the same ground. We are all, in some sense, brothers and sisters. This is extremely important. And by the way, there are a few other texts right through the Old Testament that speak about creation. The most elaborate being Job 38 to about 41, where God sort of challenges Job that and he's actually putting Job, in a sense, equal to the rest of creation. He takes Job through the whole of his zoo, showing him that, showing him the wisdom and everything that's been put into creation, actually putting Job, in some sense, equal to creation, saying, Job, in some sense, you don't know anything more than the rest of creation does. I made everything. I'm the source of life. I made everything. And that's very interesting. God doesn't elevate, in that sense, Job or his friends or any other human being above creation. We get the same idea in Psalm 104. We could get the same idea in Psalm 148. Now, this is important to understand. Because, again, we came from a culture where we thought, I at least did. It was God, then it was me, then it was the rest of creation. And so, in some sense, we as humans are also creatures rooted like other creatures in this earthly home that we share with him. In other words, to a large extent, we are part of the community of creation. And by the way, Adam names the animal. And by the way, there was this some kind of obscure interpretation some years back that someone came up with, that to name something means that you have power over them. No, I don't know if you've heard that. There is not a single commentary that agree with that. All of them say that the whole idea of naming the animals, he provides them with the potential for relationship. He provides identity. They can be known, it's actually part of it's a communal thing to do. So poor stewardship cannot work if we do not understand that we are also placed in community alongside other creatures. We need to be concerned for the well-being of animals and wider environment almost as we care for our fellow human beings. And I think that's a mind shift, if we want to take Genesis seriously, that we will have to do. Because the Enlightenment paradigm that started with Francis Bacon in the 1700s and a few other guys, that invented technology, and I don't think that was, for instance, really the idea of Francis Bacon, but that was a big spin-off of what they started. They started developing technology, And they saw the opportunity to actually transcend human beings beyond dependence on nature. So let's see if we can take technology and advance to such an extent that we don't have to be interdependent anymore on creation. And that's, of course, an unbiblical thing. Now, what's very interesting is God planted a garden, all right, which is really very cool. Now, a garden is not equal to wild nature, right? A garden is humanly cultivated nature. Are you with me? The reason I like that is God created the garden. He put the man into the garden. And he said to them, expand, become many, cultivate the ground. It's actually as if he's saying, expand the borders of the garden. Tame the wild land, make a garden out of it, and get the most out of it that you possibly can without, of course, destroying the relationships. That was what an ambassador of God, one being made in the image of God, was supposed to do. Cultivate creation. And that's very important. Something like agriculture is very important, but because we all know that nature in its wild form is not capable of providing all the human beings with all the livelihood and resources that they actually need. We need to cultivate. And this is what's really cool about this is God gives us as human beings the permission, not just the permission, the command to be creative, to create something out of nature, but to still keep on tending the garden. That's really God's main calling for all human beings. If you ever want to know what's God's main calling to all human beings, is this: tend the garden. Meaning, be creative with what you've been given. Look at nature, look at life all around you, and create something beautiful. That's why it's a good thing, not just to eat the grapes, but to make wine or something out of it. That's a good thing, to cultivate it, to create out of it. And so we are to take responsibility and to produce, very important, to produce and to caringly look after, never to exploit, but keeping this this whole thing in balance. So creation, as interdependent, Genesis 1 and 2 expresses creation as an interdependent whole, an interdependent community. Sometimes the interdependence is even greater towards the earth than our fellow human beings. I mean, a human being can live without other human beings, at least temporarily, but he can never live without the earth. Never. So there's this kind of affinity that we have with the dirt whence we come. We have this affinity with the ground out of which we come. And it's very ironic. God send us back to the dirt, go until it, and be creative and do something out of it. If there's one thing that I would really like you to remember, if you forget anything else that I've said, is the following sketch. If you could just look at this. We've always believed this. Ego. I mean, man, we're on top. And so all the other animals and things are subservient to us. Well, in a sense, they are. But maybe we should forget that for a few years and just sort of shift to this one. And just remember that God really put us in community with other animals and plants and stuff as well. And although he made us his image bearers, we own the greatest responsibility for nature. That's indeed true. But we are part of a community. If we can look at the second one, it's just I was unclear. Many would suggest that it's exactly this kind of ego paradigm that actually, at least in part, produced this. Because if we are really in charge, we can do whatever we like. This is really, then I mean, who cares? But seeing ourselves as being part of a whole ecosystem where we are responsible and where we care for the rest of the community, this, an utopia is is really possible. And by the way, the interesting thing is that before Genesis 3, that of course they ate only plants, the men, and the human beings. That's quite interesting, because in Genesis 9, God commands them to kill animals and start eating animals. And I was always thinking that what God commanded in Genesis 9 sort of negates actually what he said before the fall, when he said to the human beings, when he said to Adam and Eve, listen, you know, only plants are you about to eat. But what's interesting is some of the commentaries suggest that after Genesis 3, the whole of nature turned into violence. And although God commands this in Genesis 9, it's actually sort of a way of saying, listen, it's not the best way forward, but since violence and death is what is the only things that you give me to work with, let's work with that. Which is a really interesting thing to think about. So please, I'm not advocating vegetarianism from the sticks. I'm just saying it's very interesting that is the comment of a few learned people. So why this exploitation that we have today? Well, modern Western people forgot their creatureliness, their interdependence with other creatures, I think. They sought to liberate themselves from nature, to transcend their own independence on nature. And the idea in Genesis is that human beings should not grow food for themselves to an extent that it competes with the livelihood of other living creatures. We share the land with others. And we have this a very interesting quote from the General Synod of the Church of England that they published a few years ago. They said, we all share and depend on the same world, with its finite and often non-renewable resources. Christians believe that this world belongs to God by creation, redemption, and sustenance, and that he has entrusted it to humankind, made in his image and responsible to him. We are in the position of stewards. Those words are very important. We are in the position of stewards, tenants, curators, trustees, or guardians, whether or not we acknowledge this responsibility. Stewardship implies caring management, not selfish exploitation. It involves a concern for both present and future, as well as self, and a recognition that the world we manage as an interest in its own survival and well-being, independent of its value to us. Good stewards requires justice, truthfulness, sensitivity, compassion, and that's the General Synod of the Church of England. And then Desmond Tutu wrote an open letter to UCT. Who's that lady, Herman, that started in his... she was also a Tutu that started this fossil-free South Africa. I think it's a family member. But they started this whole fossil-free movement in the Cape. And he said the following. He said, climate change has become a profound and growing human rights issue, a threat to all of us and to the world's poorest, who are the least responsible for it, most of all. By the way, this is really the sad, sad thing. The people who has the least power are paying the most for this. Why? Because they don't have any power. They don't have any money to pay, to have access to resources or to anything else. It's the world's wealthiest countries and people who have benefited most from the use of fossil fuels and have contributed most to global warming. It is time we took full responsibility for our past actions. People of conscience need to break their ties with corporations financing the injustice of climate change. I ask UTC to examine urgently the extent of our investments in fossil fuel companies and to make a strong commitment to phasing them out as soon as possible. And that really sounds radical, but I mean, I really think it's the only way forward. We really need to break our consumption paradigm. That's the biggest thing. That means that in a sense, I as an individual can really make a difference. If a lot of us can start living, by the way, just living the life that Jesus intended for us, a non-selfish, selfless, sacrificial kind of life where we can experience the freedom of Christ, we have all the tools inherent in the gospel to save the planet. We should just live the life that Jesus intended to its fullest extent and not play Mickey Mouse, not play around with it, but really take it seriously. And then just Herman sent me some articles, which was really cool to read. And one of the things that he said was, why isn't technology helping to increase our sustainability? In other words, so many secular people say that we can actually save the planet by the technological advance that we have. Just educate people much more and educate people to use them. But the interesting thing is, the more we advanced in science and in technology, the more we create the desire and the consumption just increases. So it's not our problem lies much deeper. It might, we as Christians, I think, should believe it is at the problem of worldview. What do we really believe about life? What do we really believe about what the good life is? Because I think we as Christians in the Western world fool ourselves. I think we say that God is giving me all these comfort and riches, and that's a part of His blessing to me. And that's why, you know, I own it, and I don't really worry about it a whole lot. Now, this is a difficult thing. In some sense, God does provide, doesn't He? But we should be, I don't think we should really fool ourselves by thinking that it's theologically, biblically correct to always say, I'm so rich because God blessed me. Why didn't He bless 70% of the rest of the world? I have the power to have. Now, this is the interesting thing. If we want to really engage in poverty, by that I mean help people in poverty and upliftment, the planet does not have the resources to uplift 80% of the world to our level. The planet doesn't have that. The only solution is we who call ourselves Christians should really become Christians again and give away and be willing to sacrifice our lifestyles that consume such a lot. People, let me tell you, I'm not telling you this as someone that has conquered this idea and I really, really struggle with this. But I acknowledge and I realize that it's not something that we can hide from. Not if we're Christians, not if we follow the carpenter of Nazareth. We have to take this seriously. And so I'm going to conclude just with a few practical ideas, okay? I'm not saying this is what you have to do, but this is at least some things that we can consider. Some practical ideas. The first four or five comes from Herman, and the rest is mine. The first one is, what kind of business are you involved in? Are you involved in a business that are busy consuming high quantities of energy without giving back as much? The second thing is, what about only buying socially and economically responsible coffee? And here's an interesting thing. The slave trade was driven largely by the West's appetite for sugar. I don't know if you really know that. Is what we are doing for coffee, for instance, any different? Meaning, do we know what the living conditions are of the man or woman who farmed our coffee? The third one. What do we really need in terms of clothes? How much hot water do we really need when we take a bath in the winter? How do you invest your money? This is so very practical thing. We all invest our money just, sort of assuming that the people that take our money to multiply it or to make it grow will do it in a responsible way. But how do these places and institutions make our money grow? And we should just maybe look into that. Sixth thing, buy local stuff and organic if you can. Don't buy products out of season. But God designed nature to have specific fruits and specific vegetables for certain times of the year. It's meant to be that like, probably. So why should we be discontent with that? Because if we want something right through the year, it means a lot of energy needs to be consumed to get that out of season stuff to our doorstep. The seventh one, develop green fingers. Plant trees, make vegetable gardens. That's something really within our reach. A lot of us have big yards at home. Do something with it. Eighth, eat less meat. Have a meatless Mondays, you know, or fruitful Fridays or whatever, and you don't don't eat any meat. But by the way, you wouldn't know how much energy is being saved by just eating less meat for one day. So in other words, if you eat meat 7 days a week, just eat one day no meat, and you won't you really won't know how much can be saved if a lot of people just save one day's meat. And of course, the whole thing is to take down the demand, because there's a high demand from us, people provide in high demands. Nine, reduce your use of paper. You know, try to use only toilet paper if you can. 10, start recycling. 11, start using green medicine. This is a thing we can really start looking into. I mean, a lot of this synthetic medicine that we use is anyway not of a big help a lot of the times. And the last one, there are a lot, but I sort of decided I need to stop somewhere to save you guys. Worship God to whom everything belongs. And what I mean by that is don't just worship him and sing songs to him, but worship him as the owner of everything that exists on the planet. Worship him as the one to whom everything that I own actually belongs. And so I close again with the question, what kind of person would you like to be? Like all other principles in Scripture, our willingness to obey, in this instance, will also answer this to the largest extent. And I want to close just with the idea that, again, we couldn't finish this off by thinking about the cross and the resurrection of Jesus. That's the way Christians are supposed to live. Sacrifice so that we can experience the life of the resurrection. Live the way of the cross to experience the power of the resurrection. That's the way of Jesus. That's the way that we should follow. And I think this is not an easy topic to discuss, let me tell you. It can get extremely complicated. You think you save some energy here, and by doing this, you actually, you know, expend a lot of energy in some other way that you didn't realize. So it's really a complex issue, but we cannot longer be quiet about this. I think as followers of Christ, we really should start talking about this. So I'm going to close just with a worship song, actually, and it's just entitled "The Earth Is Yours." It's a worship song where we acknowledge, and let's just sort of summarize this whole idea tonight by singing these words to God, by giving creation back to him. If that's a longing of your heart, if you're still in a place where you sort of investigate and think about this, you know, feel free to do so. But let's just reflect on this while we look and listen to the song. Thanks, everyone.
Your voice, it thunders, the oaks start twisting, the forest sounds with cedars breaking, the waters see you and start their riding, from the depths a song is rising. It's rising from the ground. Holy, 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 holy Lord. The earth is yours and it's singing. Holy, 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 holy Lord. The earth is yours. Starts composing the fields and trees, they start rejoicing. And now it's rising from the ground.
Vader, ons, ja, ons let die woorde echo. Ons weet het, die aarde is die sin. En Heng, Heere, ons weet nie eens waar om te begin, om u te gehoorsaam nie. Ons weet nie eens waar om te begin, om redig verskil te maak nie. Heere, en het, Heng, dis vir ons baie om op te gee. Want ons leef levens wat redig gemakkelijk is. Ek praat redig vir myself, heel eerste. Maar help ons om nie hierdie te sien as opoffering nie. Maar is een manier op pad in die lewe. Lewe vir baie meer mense as net ons. Baie meer van die skepping, van die community van skepping as net ons. So Lord, we just want to ask you that you would really provide us with creativity and with wisdom and with knowledge and insight as to how to go forward. We pray that, Lord Jesus, in your name, and we ask you, lead us into your way. Help us to live your way and to walk in your footsteps. We pray that in your name. Amen. Okay, goody. Any comments? Please feel free. I mean, there's one there at the back. Arnold. Okay. I hear you, brother. I hear you. Okay. Okay. That's also really cool about, you know, the gold and the sapphire and all the stones that are beneath the earth. The reason it's mentioned is that it is really there for us, for our use. It's been explicitly mentioned the same way we just mentioned agriculture. It's part of taking what's there and cultivating it. So it's having done this message that does not, you know, mean we leave everything where it is and we don't do anything anymore. And everything that's gone through human hands, you know, is dirty and bad. God really gave this to us to be creative with it and to do something with it, but to such a, you know, in such a fashion that life holistically will still be able to continue in harmony. So that's actually the only thing that I wanted to say. Thanks for reminding me. Yes, Harwan. Oh. Yes, there are two. Manette and Derek.
New Age. Okay. Ek mag dalk nou nie meer die fondste persoon in die kamer wees hiernaar nie. Ek stem baie saam met jou dat ons moet kyk na die aarde en ons moet hom oppas en dit half. Ja, dit is belangrik om dit te doen. Maar daar's 'n paar goeders wat jy afgenoem het wat ek nogals 'n bietjie vind as daar's baie flaws.
Ja.
Soos as mens kyk na die planeet, half almal sê so van alles wat so smelt en die aarde wat so warm word en dit is waar. Maar vat byvoorbeeld soos die ijsberg wat 'n hele rukkie terug na hul gesmelt het en goed soos dit. Omtrent op dieselfde tyd het 'n splinter nuwe een opgepop wat groter was as die een wat gesmelt het. Apart van dit is daar almal wat sê van die weer wat so hektiek is en goed soos dit en die aardbewings en die tsunamies en goeters. Die wêreld gaan deur siklusse. Baie scientists het nou al baie diep gaan dit ondersoek. Ja. En hulle het agtergekom dat die wêreld gaan deur siklusse.
Sure.
Dit beteken nie, wat ek nie sê nou, is dat ons is glad nie besig om skade te doen in die aarde nie, want ek dink ons doen skade. Sure. Ek dink nie die hoeveelheid wat ons skade aandoen, is baie minder. Dan, ek dink dis juist mense wat in poverty lewe, wat meer damage doen aan die aarde as wat ons doen. Ek werk nou in Pakhuis, en dit is omtrent een van die meer ryker areas in Johannesburg. En meer as 3/4 van die mense wat inloop in die winkel, het so 'n groot fokus op energy saving, om environmentally friendly te wees.
Sure.
Dat ek weet nie meer of mense kan sê dat die mense wat bevoorreg is, is juist die mense wat besig is om die aarde onder te bring nie. Dan is daar baie mense wat tegnologie gebruik juist om maniere te kry om weg te beweeg van goeders wat die aarde so seer maak.
Oh ja, ja, sure.
So ja.
Okay, let me comment on each of those. The first is the Earth and the planet does go through cycles and so on. That's very true. In the early 90s, there was this great, almost violent debate from a large extent of people, a large group of people that actually used the same arguments, that said that we actually are just going through cycles. The Earth is not really getting warmer, and so forth and so on. That debate, I think, is to a large extent passé. Like, for instance, the 10 hottest years in the last 100 years were all in the last 14 years. That's a fact. It's definitely going up. And the whole thing is we don't realize how little in temperature the Earth temperature needs to rise to make a big difference. It only, I think up until the end of this century, it only has to rise like 2 or 3 degrees in general. That will make a very, very big difference. So I really think I know about the school of thought, you know, that rejects that. But I honestly don't buy to it anymore. I don't think it's very relevant anymore. The second thing is that it's there are also a lot of poor people that are damaged. Absolutely, that's definitely so. I just think we're not part of them. Okay, we have the power. So the question is, we have more power than they do. And what can we do with that power? That is the question as Christians, I think, we should ask. And I think it's maybe a quite a big statement to say they are doing more damage. They don't have that much power. They do damage, I agree with you. But the general consensus is that in general, the people with the money are the consumers because the problem is being created by consumption, and that's the big thing. The third thing, I can't remember what you said, the last thing that you said.
It was just about technology. But... Oh, yeah, okay. Technology is not right. That's fine. I know there's a lot of technology that's not good. Then there's another thing about the organic waste and good. I think organic waste is very good, and I think we can very bevoordeel raak om meer organies te lewe. Maar mens moet baie versigtig wees oor wat se organic food jy koop.
I agree.
Want baie van die organic food wat mens koop, veral by Woolies, is actually nie besig om regtig organic te wees nie en dit bevorder eintlik poverty.
Ja, ja.
En baie keer as hulle sê dat ja, jy weet jy moet nie die koei of whatever die beeste inspuit met antibiotika nie, maak jy actually die diere seer.
Ja.
Want hulle moet nou deur al hierdie siektes gaan en goeders. So mens moet regtig versigtig wees. Ja. Where what's the organic food means cry?
I agree with your whole statement, except the antibiotics part. That's plain poison. And animals don't need it. This is not controversial. I'm rather sure of this. But I agree with you concerning the organic. There are a lot of foods in shops that have labels organic on them that doesn't mean anything. So if you want to really know actually how to distinguish between what kind of organic food to buy or not, go talk to Marie. She'll tell you exactly what to do and how to buy food. Derek in Dan Jan. The technology thing. Herman, won't you just... Can I afford those articles that you sent to me? Those articles, they are one of those articles that really goes in depth about the effect of technology. That's very true. People believe that technology can actually help saving power, but it shows you all the graphs and the research how that actually has the opposite effect. It's being done with good intentions, but in developing that technology, it creates a bigger demand, so we just consume more, so it doesn't really have an effect. So that's a thing that I'm going to forward. To some of you would really like it. Derek?
I was just wondering, in terms of contradictory statements and goals. I work in research in the mining industry, how to do things more effectively.
In what industry?
Mining.
Oh, mining industry, yeah.
Minerals, metals, and
yeah,
mining.
Sure.
Anyone driving through Limpopo or Mpumalanga will see the damage that mining does. Mm. So I can justify that maybe by saying that to do that more effectively and to use what we get out of the ground better, but it's still the thing that's it is destructive and a disruptive industry. So as a Christian, how would you say to balance that? Yeah. I mean, it's fine driving through that and saying, sure, look at all this destruction, but going in a car to the Kruger National Park for a holiday, I mean, the car has to come from somewhere.
It
has to be built by something. It's not wood. Otherwise, you can get an ox carton or some, voortrekker.
Let's go back to the voortrekkers, man.
So
yeah.
And so you can say, all right, cell phones, that's one of the big issues at the moment. Everyone wants a cell phone, and you can arrange a wonderful seminar on how to save energy, but a cell phone needs to come from somewhere. Someone has to build it, silicon, gold, all those things. It's rather contradictory. If Desmond Tutu says he wants to shut down fossil fuels, you can go nuclear, but no one can handle nuclear waste. It's still better in the long run, cost-effective-wise, to do coal energy than doing nuclear energy. It's just not, at the moment, a viable energy. So the coal being processed at Medupi can last us for another 100 years.
Oh, yeah.
The reserve is just so massive at the moment.
Sure.
And, okay, great, I understand that it's destructive, but if you're in a hospital, you do want electricity there.
Yeah.
You do want something like that there. You do want the metal instruments. You do want that technology. How do you handle these contradictory things? Because on the one side, I understand we want to use things effectively and efficiently, but at the moment, we're just efficiently using more things, efficiently using more stuff.
Yeah, so to this point, where I really wish that Johan did the talk, not me. But no, you're absolutely right, and I think this is where the debate really becomes very complex, and we really need really clever people to help us solve it. But here's the principle. The principle is we should give more than we take. That's the principle. And how exactly that works, I think it's very complex. And we really need guys like you and like some of you guys who do science and engineering and so on that can really help us solve this. And maybe you should do the next one. You know, come up with a great thing and say, listen, okay, I've worked through all the data. I went through all the options, and I've come up with an idea that this is how we can really give more than we take. So that's the big thing. And that's a very simple principle in general. I really got that from Ern McManus. He said, in general, in relationships, in technology, in business, everything, he likes to give 51% and take only 49%. Now, just try that. I mean, that's really difficult. And that's the point. If we don't turn it around, we're gonna die. I mean, by we I mean the planet. And it's not trying to be pessimistic. I mean, God can do anything along the way if He wants to. He can hopefully He'll come before something happens. I don't know But by the way, who have you watched the movie Interstellar? Okay, it's not really about saving the planet. It's actually assuming that it's already gone down the drain. Where are we going to find a new place to how are we going to salvage humankind? And by the way, the biblical themes of faith and love and hope, and especially salvation, when it comes to hope, is very, very prominent in the movie. The solution that they give is just, sucky. But anyway, very, very good movie. Derek, thanks. So anything else? Anyone else? Last one. Oh, yeah, Jan. Sorry.
While I was living in Ermelo, I was involved with a friend of mine who worked at the Nooit Gedacht agricultural farm. That is where they develop new agricultural technologies. And everybody is going on about organic as the way to go, but there's actually a better way to produce agricultural products that are in some fashions a lot healthier than organic foods, and that's called biological farming.
Okay, yeah.
Now, biological farming means that you work with nature.
Yeah.
It doesn't exclude the use of chemicals, but it regulates it in a fashion that it doesn't have the impact that the current chemical farming system has on our health. I mean, you can directly link the rise in cancer to the use of chemicals in farming.
Yes.
So biological farming is all about the soil, which is interesting. It goes back to what you said, we all came from the soil. Now, what it means is that you prepare the soil in such a fashion that the soil is healthy and produces healthy plants. For instance, that maize has got this little dimple on the end of the kernel. Now that means that the maize has lost 50% of its food value.
Okay.
So in other words, I've got a few friends that actually implemented this biological farming scheme on their farms,
yeah.
And the yields increased from about 4 tons of maize per hectare to about 10 tons. So you increase the yields, you increase the health of the foods, and at the same time you help the environment, because on the same patch of ground you've got a larger yield of agricultural whatever you're planting.
Cool.
And animals.
Yeah, I really think that ways like that is the way to go forward. And of course there are things like hydroponics, you know, and a lot of very fascinating ways to look at this. But thanks. But I think what's important is, it's very clear that some of us have already started thinking about this and reading about this. That's the important thing. Start thinking about this, because it is our responsibility. Yes.
Jy het begin hier te sê dit is 'n hot topic, of hy het gesê, en, maar dit is nie 'n hot topic in kerke oor die algemeen, denk ek nie. En kan jy net iets daaroor sê, want jy het laatst 'n comment gemaak van wat die kerke en wie oor praat. Ons praat nie oor in die kerke.
Thanks, Nico. It's very hard for me to answer that without sounding cynical and, you know, even, you know, a little angry. I've been out of the mainline church world since 2001 up until, you know, the end of last year. Planting two churches and the second being the Alur. And it's really great to me to work with people like you and the previous church that I was involved in that are really, you know, that are really passionate and engaging, and they think about these things. And I've become involved in fairly traditional churches again since the beginning of this year. I help several churches, and I must say, you can ask my wife, I'm an optimist, okay? I irritate her with my optimism. But I'm telling you that church irritates the living daylights out of me. Because they are so far behind in their thinking. They have a very dualist way of looking at theology and the Bible. You know, everything material is almost bad. Only the spiritual things are good. How is looking after the environment spiritual? I mean, God's going to destroy the earth anyway, you know. So, and there's no idea of stewardship. This belongs to God. It's not up to us to decide what happens to his planet. We are... And a very poorly developed view of kingdom. Kingdom, Jesus talked about kingdom much more as a reality here and now than a reality in the future. It also includes the future, of course. And we should start taking that seriously. So, Nico, sorry, to talk about the churches, I'm just really, you know, God is doing some great things in other churches all over the world, but my own experience of churches in our country, they are just... Not only concerning this, several other topics as well. Evangelism, how to evangelize, how to engage with people outside of faith and so on. It's just terrifying to me. The church is in big trouble, and I don't know how to rectify that. God just needs to do something very big, very quickly in the church. I'm just very discouraged.